Back with you Monday, March 1st, new month, new week on Connecticut Today. In the 4 o'clock hour, Governor Ned Lamont with the latest COVID-19 update. 5 p.m. hour, Sue Hatfield joined us. She's now the interim chairman of the Connecticut Republican Party. And I also had some thoughts about the licensing procedure and a lot of the left and right give and take regarding marijuana legalization for recreational use in the state. All is not well, according to the folks at the CT News Junkie about this, Hugh McQuaid's story. CT News Junkie, the governor's bill would allow cannabis sales starting in May of next year, not this year, May of 2022. So if you're planning to open a pizzeria, if you're planning to set up a little rack outside your house and sell Doritos, Cheetos, Fritos. You know what I like? Those corkscrew Fritos. Oh, those are the best. Pizza, whatever you may sell. It would legalize possession of up to 1.5 ounces, which is a lot of weed. That's not a little bit of weed. And reduce penalties, blah, blah, blah. Now, the legislation would clear the records of some minor cannabis possession convictions, automatically expunging the records of possession convictions before October 1 of 2015. Those convicted later would be required to ask a court to erase them. So you got this? Understand what's going on here? So prior to October 1 of 2015, not as Mark said earlier here on the show, Rich said, we're not talking about heavyweight dealers here. We're talking about possession charges, which for the longest time have been in this state, I think, like misdemeanors, but they are in your record. So the bill would clear the records of some minor cannabis possession convictions, expunging records. I love that word. It sounds like what it does. It expunges records of possession convictions before October 1, 2015. Those convicted later would be required to ask a court to erase them. Okay, so if it's past October 1 of 2015... you got to go to a court and state your case. All right, you have to hire a lawyer, maybe. However, critics say the proposal does not give communities most damaged by the prohibition a fair shot at building a new market that legalization would create. State Senator Jorge Cabrera of Hamden said, quote, there really aren't too many opportunities in government that come along where you're really going to be essentially creating an entirely new market. The reality is, if we don't get this right and create access, whether capital for entrepreneurs to start their businesses or create a level playing field, this is going to take off and it's going to be near impossible to catch up. Progressive advocates were lobbying support for a different proposal co-sponsored by Rep. Robin Porter of New Haven. The bill includes provisions ensuring the ability of workers in the new industry to unionize and create a workforce development pipeline for people with marijuana-related convictions. During the hearing, lawmakers and members of the public challenged the administration's decision not to legalize home cultivation of the cannabis plant as part of the idea. Instead, the bill would reduce penalties for growing the substance and order the State Consumer Protection Department to conduct a study on home growth. Mwah, mwah. Lawmakers on both sides of the aisle questioned the call. Well, there you go. Members of the public also told lawmakers they want to grow at home. Bridgeport resident Bernice Wright, who has lupus, said Connecticut's medical marijuana program has enabled her to forego medication she once took to control her syndrome. That's good. Participating in the hearing online from her home, Wright showed lawmakers bags full of medicine she no longer needed. The ability to grow cannabis at home would save her money. Of course it would. Of course it would, Bernice. But they don't want you to save all the money. They want to get the taxes off of you, Bernice. Paul Mounds, Lamont's chief of staff, said the governor was not yet comfortable with the idea of home cultivation. Mohit Agrawal, a deputy policy director of the administration, said it posed regulatory challenges. Well, yeah, I mean, people could grow it like crazy and sell it. And again, they haven't figured out how to get their paws on the money here. So that's where we are. But the other aspect of this whole thing that is just, we're really getting tangled up in this whole thing of, well, the bill can pass because it's got to right wrongs. It's got to right wrongs. It's got to right past wrongs. And I think, folks, I'm telling you, the more I read about this and the more I talk to people here, how should I put this? From a moral point of view, and this is not the same thing as alcohol is. It's not. When I make these arguments, it drives me crazy when people call in and say, oh, well, alcohol does the same thing. No, it does not. Learn some basic science. You can have a glass of wine or a beer with a full dinner and not have your frame of mind altered. It just doesn't work that way. Or you can have a small glass of wine, little white wine. Now, if you overdo it, of course. But if you're taking it with food, essentially, you know, yeah, it may show up in your blood alcohol level, but are you impaired? Probably not. If you abuse it, yeah, you are. But, you know, I it's starting to get on me a little bit here that it sounds to me like this whole thing is being looked at as some sort of golden goose here. That, well, we've got all these new possibilities. Look at this industry. We've got all this that previously wronged areas can take advantage of. And we're going to have deliveries. And we're going to have all sorts of recurring industry here. Retail licenses, mail order licenses. Pardon me, but we're talking about something here that alters your state of mind. Has anybody stopped to think about that? Seriously, has anybody, do me a favor, rub the dollar signs away from your eyes for a minute and think about the fact that we're looking at this like it's the greatest thing since sliced freaking bread. And you want to legalize it, fine. Okay, that's eventually going to happen. I don't think there's anything stopping it now, unless it's a language of a bill. But my God, we talk about this thing like it's some sort of life-affirming substance. It's something that you either eat or smoke that alters your frame of mind. I have an idea. As I talked about on this show the other day, instead of looking at pot as some sort of golden goose for the inner cities in this state, can we do better outside of marijuana? Again, we've been confronted with inner city problems in this state, in this country, for 50, 60, 70 years, and they don't seem to go away. But for some reason now, we're looking at this whole thing with marijuana. Oh, we're going to right past wrongs. We're going to start delivery services, retail outlets. So what? Do you want everybody to start smoking? Your market is only going to be, it's a defined market. What do you want this thing to spread like it's McDonald's? You know? Hey, only now it's the new McWeed. I mean, is that the kind of thing you want here? Calm down with the economic value of this and the economic. How about we do other things economically to help inner cities? I don't know. Get people in there and pay no and have them pay no tax on certain buildings or something to get businesses back in the city. Instead of, we're in this maniacal thing about weed. It's going to be this life-affirming, this saving grace. Come on, understand what this is. And it's not the same as booze. Stop that.
I think what you see is the positivity rate stays quite low. I think it's about 2.6 for the 7 days. Hospitalizations at a probably 4-month low. Average daily fatalities still too high, but continuing to trend lower. And these are all reasons to make sure that we believe that we're making progress in the war against COVID. And that's why on Thursday we're going to be able to make some announcements in terms of our cautious reopening, in terms of capacity for our stores and our restaurants and our retail and personal services. You'll hear a little bit more about that on Thursday. The vaccine update. 75% of our people 75 and above have been vaccinated. As you know, after you get about 70% of the people vaccinated, it gets a little tougher to get the other 30%, but we're continuing to make progress there. Over half of our people, 65 to 74, have been vaccinated. 39,000 doses of J&J are arriving this week. That's important because, as you know, we opened up to 55 and above today. As you can imagine, the phones were very busy. The websites were very busy. Most of the slots filled up quite quickly within a few hours. If you called 211, you're still going to be getting some calls back, you know, over the course of the day. But this is, with these new doses arriving, there will be additional appointments available over the course of the week. So keep your eyes open on that. 156,000 total doses in this week. I know, as you remember, just from a month ago, we were at about less than 50,000 a week. 156,000 is a lot. We're not positive we're going to keep that high number up over the course of the next week or two, but we are tracking this very carefully. 964,000 total doses administered to date. And that doesn't include what we have in the Veterans Administration. That doesn't include what you have with the tribes, which get a separate allocation. So probably over a million people in the state of Connecticut have received their first vaccination shot to date. What does that mean? First of all, there's been a lot of talk about how fast we get people vaccinated, and what does that mean? And does it mean too much? I don't think so. As you can see from the chart on the right, the United States, about 15% of the populations across the other states have received about their first dose, their first vaccination. In the state of Connecticut, it's almost 20%. What does that mean? That means we have 160,000 more people in Connecticut who've been vaccinated than would otherwise be the case based upon the national average. 160,000 people. That saves lives. That keeps people out of the hospital. That stops the spread. And as you know, we continue to look at those variants. That stops the spread, gives us better chance to keep our schools open. Our schools are more likely to be open than anybody else in the region. Allows us to continue to reopen our businesses, more on that on Thursday, and what that means for jobs, what that means for getting this pandemic behind us. The next chart, Max. Speed also has to do with simplicity. And simplicity has a lot to do with equity. Sometimes there's considered a false choice between speed and equity. But first of all, simplicity means that nobody can cheat the system. Simplicity means that there are no line jumpers. You can't go to linejumpers.com, or you see from Seattle, line jumpers dodge the Washington State eligibility rules. CBS Los Angeles, vaccine line jumpers heading out to hard-hit communities, using access codes wrongly to jump ahead of the line. USA Today, cutting, bribing, stealing. You know, if you're one of the folks lucky enough to have a doctor, you can probably get that signed doctor's permit that you have the comorbidity. If you're one of the 20%+ of folks here in the state that don't have that, that's not something that you can do. So I do think that simplicity also means a lot in terms of equity. You probably saw that funny skit on Saturday Night Live for the opening on this past weekend, where number of people were pretending to learning how to smoke again so they could claim smoking as a comorbidity. Next chart, Max. Simplicity means equity, and it also is in the interests of public health. And by categorizing by age, that prioritizes public health. You know, we've had 7,600 fatalities related to COVID over the last year here in the state of Connecticut. And, you know, the vast majority of them are people over the age of 65. And, you know, three quarters of those, or over half of those 65, have been vaccinated. You see what a difference that's making. But you even see in the younger age groups here that, you know, 55 to 64, you're probably 20 times more likely to suffer complications, 20 times more likely hospitalizations and fatalities than those in their 30s. So it makes an enormous difference. So age prioritizes public health, and age is simpler, and that means equity. And finally, we reinforce our particular emphasis and make sure that no disadvantaged, underserved community is left behind. And these are communities that have suffered the hardest over the course of COVID, and some of the communities that it's not as easy for them to get vaccinated. So our goal is to make sure that we have everybody equally vaccinated across our great state. So we're working closely with the federally qualified health centers, the hospitals, the pharmacies, the local health departments. And we've gone to the 50 most disadvantaged zip codes in the state of Connecticut. Disadvantaged meaning based on poverty levels, based upon dense housing, based upon multi-generational housing. Those communities where you're most likely to have the spread of the virus. And sometimes those very same communities are less likely to get vaccinated. So A, we're reaching out aggressively to those communities. We're going to allocate 25% of the vaccine to those communities to make sure they get vaccinated, even if we have to work extra hard to make sure they get vaccinated. Look, Deirdre and Josh and I, we've been out there working. It was at Waterbury, there at the Arts Magnet School, signing people up, what they're doing to get people vaccinated there. Just this last Friday, down in Bridgeport, meeting with many of the ministers, each of whom was back in the pulpit preaching on a Sunday, emphasizing the importance of getting vaccinated and where you could get vaccinated quickly and how you could get vaccinated safely. So we're working very closely with our provider community to make sure this is a priority as well. That just gives you a quick update of where we are one day into 55 and above. More vaccines to come. More slots are going to be open. I know there was some frustration. A lot of people at the front door all trying to squeeze through at 12:01 this morning or 8 a.m. this morning. But we've got tens of thousands of people who have made their appointments already. You know that, Jason, I just love it if you could say a few words about, in particular, the vaccines. We just got the J&J approval. We'll be getting 39,000 doses over the next few days, what that means to people, how they should think about it, and basically our vaccination strategy. Jason Schwartz.
Sure. Thanks, Governor. It's great to be with you on another milestone day, I think, for the vaccination program in Connecticut, not just because of the expansion to this new group of residents of Connecticut and to the teachers and child care providers, but also because of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, which we'll now have available within these next coming days and be able to add to our vaccination program. The Johnson & Johnson vaccine will give us now three vaccines, all of which are highly effective at preventing those severe outcomes of COVID-19 that we're all working so hard to prevent, the hospitalizations, the ICU admissions, and the deaths. The Johnson & Johnson vaccine has shown very high levels of efficacy against those cases of severe COVID-19. And in fact, a month, 4 weeks after individuals received that vaccine in the clinical trial, there were no hospitalizations as a result of COVID-19, and there were no deaths due to COVID-19 among individuals who received the vaccine in the clinical trial. So this is a fantastic vaccine. We have three fantastic vaccines, all of which are also remarkably safe. The safety story for the J&J vaccine is fantastic. This is a vaccine that our science subcommittee of the vaccine advisor group has been following, as we have throughout the vaccine story over these last several months. And in the last week, our science subcommittee, we were looking at the same data that the FDA advisors were reviewing, the data from the manufacturers, the data from the FDA scientists. We met over the weekend as well to discuss the data, discuss the vaccine, and our science subcommittee was thrilled with what we saw about the J&J vaccine, and we're glad that we're going to have it available. So we now have three vaccines. They're all fantastic, and the opportunity for now the vaccination program here in Connecticut to accelerate with the added supply, with these added vaccines, and the opportunity for individuals to receive any vaccine that's available as soon as it's available and as soon as it's their turn to do it, I think is really the important message as we enter this new phase of the vaccination program. So I think that's where we are with the J&J vaccine, and I think it's an exciting new addition now to our toolkit as we move forward.
Well, Jason is sticking around to answer your questions, as are Paul and Deirdre and Josh and myself.
NBC Connecticut. Good afternoon, Governor. Matt Austin with NBC Connecticut. Just following up with, you know, with what Jason was saying about Johnson & Johnson, in terms of this vaccine, how is it going to be distributed here in the state? And will people have a choice, basically, of which vaccine they receive?
Josh, you want to take that?
Yes. So we will be, all of our providers are going to be making visible in the reservation process which vaccine is associated with that appointment slot. So we want people to have visibility and transparency into what vaccine will be available. And so over the weekend, the team was working in preparation for, in anticipation of the approval of the J&J vaccine over the weekend to survey our providers, see who would express interest and capacity to be able to take on J&J vaccine this week. We actually received far more requests for J&J than we had even the 39,000 doses that have been allocated. So that's great news. And our fantastic team at DPH worked through the weekend, got the orders in last night as soon as they were able to be ordered. Those should be in transit as we speak. And it's actually going to enable, in many cases, us to bring forward a lot of those educator clinics that may have had to be pushed further out into the later in the month, be able to bring some of those in even sooner and provide a lot of additional access across the state, new appointments that will be opening up in the coming days to help deal with the hundreds of thousands of additional people who became eligible today. So great news.
And Governor, I know you were kind of referencing the frustration some people might have felt today when they were trying to sign up and register for a vaccine appointment. I'm wondering what you want to say, I guess, to them in terms of when things should even out a little bit and when they should expect to be able to find more openings.
It'll probably take a week or so. So I urge you to be patient. If, again, if you can telecommute or you don't have any great urgency there, give others a chance to go forward. I think that would be surely appropriate. But look, I think we've got about 500,000 people all going for those 100,000 doses. So you can see there's going to be a bit of a line right now. But if we had done it the other way, we would have had about 1.8 million people all trying to go for those same number of doses. So it's going to take a little bit of patience, but I think it'll sort itself out over the next week or so.
And finally, any update on the travel advisory?
We're going to be making some announcements on that on Thursday as well, but we'll be opening up the travel a little bit more, trying to get some confirmation from my fellow governors.
Okay, thank you.
Channel 3 Eyewitness News.
Yes, Governor, you know, the state is committed to the age-based rollout, and in an effort to accommodate everyone who does want a vaccine, you indicated that speed is really going to be crucial going forward. So I wanted to ask about the state's stance on extra vaccines. For example, you know, these are the ones that may be discarded at the end of the business day at a pharmacy or a clinic. Is there any guidance for these clinics or pharmacies that find themselves discarding doses at the end of the day?
Deirdre, I hope we're not discarding many vaccines at the end of the day.
We have as we've been saying all along, we have a policy of use the vaccine you get within 9 days of receiving it, and no dose go to waste. And every vaccine provider is asked to have a process in place for what to do with doses at the end of the day and work backwards through our eligibility groups. We also have a requirement that they notify us of any wastage, and we are not hearing about wastage of vaccine. We are hearing about some providers that have a few doses left at the end of the day and they're administering them to volunteers, but we are not hearing about doses that are being discarded. And our vaccine providers, for the most part, treat this like the precious commodity that it is.
Absolutely. So, I mean, there should be like a waiting list of sorts for certain pharmacies to kind of go through that list.
Yes. As part of the provider agreement, providers are setting up processes to make sure that either they don't open a vial at the end of the day if they don't have enough people to give it to, or they have a way to use all the doses at the end of the day.
And with more shipments coming in, are we expecting to expand hours at vaccine clinics or pharmacies?
We ask our providers to use all the doses they get within 9 days of receiving them. So we do anticipate that some of them may be expanding either weekend or evening or both to get all of the doses used that they're receiving this week, since we're getting such a large shipment.
Thank you very much.
Fox 61.
Hi, Governor. Zania Maldonado, Fox 61. I believe we're seeing maybe the biggest rush to get vaccinated out of this age group today, those ages 55 and between 64. Considering the population of that age group in Connecticut and the average number of doses the state has been receiving, I think many want to know, what is an estimated time frame for how long it could take for majority of this group to be vaccinated?
It depends, obviously, on the number of vaccines we got, but let's assume we're going to be able to ramp up slowly from, 100,000 plus every week. We've got a cohort of, say, 500,000 in that age group, and maybe 70% are going to want to get vaccinated. We'll see what that time is, at least over the next few weeks. So we really think that over the next 3 weeks, we'll be able to go to the next age cohort.
Guest a week ago tonight was elected the new chair of the Connecticut Republican Party. She will serve out the term of J.R. Romano, and then the party will hold another election in June. She was the Republican nominee for Attorney General last time that office was contested, losing to the current Attorney General William Tong, but she did get 46.5% of the vote. A previous registered nurse also works in the office of the chief state's attorney. Again, somebody else with a far better resume than me. That's how it works here. Sue Hatfield is the guest. Hi, Sue. It's Paul at WICC. How are you?
Hi, Paul. How are you? Thank you so much for having me on today. It's a pleasure to be here.
A week ago tonight, Sue, you were elected to fill out the term of J.R. Romano. What made you want to step in and do this, even as you have said, Sue, if it's only for the next few months? Why'd you do this?
Yeah, so I was serving as the vice chair since 2019. I didn't have any initial intention to step in the race. However, thinking more about it, I did believe it was my duty. Many of the Republican leaders, as well as state central members, came to me, asked me if I would step into this role, run for the election after great consideration. I did so, and we've really been moving the party forward, and I continue to do so until the fourth Tuesday in June, when the election will be held per the bylaws of our state party, and where I'll be able to turn the party over, hopefully stronger than it is than when I received the party to the next chairman.
So you have no desire, Sue, to go for a full 2-year term. Is it a logistic thing with you, or what is it? Because most people would see this and say, "Hey, why not run for 2 years or a full 2-year term?" Your thoughts on that?
Absolutely. So right now I do have a full-time job. So essentially I have two full-time jobs. I wake up very early in the morning to go through my party emails, as well as working late into the night and weekends, also attending to party business. So essentially I have two full-time jobs, a family, and right at this moment in time, I have chosen not to run for the full 2-year time, but I am going to put every ounce of energy that I have into the next 4 months. We've already done some wonderful things, both the staff and many of the leaders in the party, but fundraising, that's a top priority of mine. And since JR resigned on January 12th, between pledges and in-the-door contributions, we've raised about $130,000. So we've really been rallying as a party to right the ship move the party forward and, really get a financially stable party, first and foremost. And what's really exciting during these last few weeks is when I asked my former boss, Speaker Newt Gingrich, to help us out. He did so, and he helped with a fundraising email for the Connecticut State Party, which I that was a really wonderful thing that he did. So it's really been a team effort between you know, my former boss and the leaders, the other officers in the party, and, you know, the state central members, everybody has been pulling for the party that we all love to make it a stronger party for the next chairman in June.
Having worked on a couple of campaigns, Sue, a year ago, I can remember those campaign meetings when, and you well know this, having made, you know, runs yourself, where, you know, the first question after everybody sits down to the table is, okay, how much money do we have? And it's a fact of politics, right? And we all know about that. And we all say, oh, no, there's no money for Republicans in this state. But as you just said, if you go about it the right way, I think, and you present your case, I think there certainly is.
There is. And right now, people are really excited about moving our state forward. And it, case in point is there was six candidates for who were running for state party chair, you know, a week ago. So that is, you know, a case in point as to there is a lot of people willing to step up to help the party move forward and move our state forward.
Sue, there was a couple of stories in the past couple, 3 weeks that featured what I think some of the writers said, oh, you know, it's the plight of the state Republican Party, you know, post-Donald Trump. Look what happened at the representation in the General Assembly, in the State House, in the State Senate over the four Trump years. Well, what's your reaction to that when people say, well, Mr. Trump was a drag on the party? Agree with that or not?
Well, my position is right now people look at Connecticut as it's not affordable. Connecticut is not affordable. Our residents are leaving our state day in and day out. Our businesses are leaving. Businesses are choosing not to relocate to Connecticut. So I think many folks that I speak with every day in Connecticut, they are looking to the Republican Party to really, you know, fix our state so they can live here, they can affordably live here, that their children will want to return after they are educated and come back to Connecticut. And, you know, I think everything is local. Everything is local in politics, and people are looking at what is happening to their state that, you know, it used to be a very prosperous state. And now what we have is we have budgets that have a lot of pork in them. Those, you know, and the Republicans time and time again are saying we don't have a revenue problem. We have a spending problem here. And, you know, we really need Republican leadership here in Connecticut to really go through the budget and to cut some of that pork out and make Connecticut a place that is more affordable. We need smaller government. We need less taxes. And we overall, what I'm hearing as well is that we need unity within our party and within our friends and neighbors and family. We need to be unified as a party and then also to instill a level of civility among our friends and families and neighbors and people first, aside from politics.
Sue Hatfield is the guest, the chair till June of the Connecticut Republican Party. Sue, you know, obviously, we Connecticut is a raw vote state. You know, we don't elect governors the way we elect presidents with electoral colleges and all that. Are we at the point now, Sue, when you made a run for statewide office a couple of years ago, did relatively well, but unfortunately William Tong beat you. Are we at the point now, Sue, where the Republican Party has to peel away some votes from the blue areas of this state, Hartford, Bridgeport, New Haven, to be viable, to make the tent wider, to combine with its strength in the suburbs?
Absolutely. We cannot you know, overlook any area in Connecticut. And when I ran for Attorney General, I would go to Bridgeport and Hartford and other communities, you know, as well as the suburbs. You know, I left no rock unturned. And one story was, I remember going into a laundromat and I met a gentleman there. He said, "What are you doing on a laundromat campaign?" And I said, "Well, you're here. You're a voter. You're a resident of Connecticut." So really, we need to go everywhere that there are voters and there are residents of Connecticut. We cannot really afford not to engage all of our residents and all of our voters.
Finally, Sue, if you were to make a very short wish list, one or two, for the next person who will serve out a full 2-year term as chair of the party, what would that be? Couple of basic points.
Yeah, so one of the items that I'm currently working on, and I hope that will begin the bridge to the next chairman or chairwoman, is to foster a strong working relationship between our Connecticut Republican Party and our legislative leaders, Senate Republican leader Kevin Kelly and House Republican leader Vin Candelora. That was one of my first outreaches after I was elected chair. I reached out to both of them and I let them know that every month I will be inviting them personally to our state central meetings. I've added a legislative update agenda item so they can come and be a part of the discussion. We need to have uniform messaging between the state GOP as well as our legislative leaders. We all need to be on the same page. So that's the first thing, is to start developing a very strong working relationship with our legislative leaders. The other item is our RTC, our RTCs across the state. So since I took after J.R. Romano resigned, I started having RTC chair Zoom calls, and on March 9th, we'll have a third Zoom conference. I hope to really build the infrastructure and get some excitement back within the RTCs and get them involved, because the RTCs, everything is local. We need to have a very a grassroots effort that's coordinated between all of the RTC chairmen in each and every town and city of Connecticut. So that's the other item that I am working on. The other item is messaging and communication. So I have established a communications committee, which is a rapid response team to get the information out quickly statewide when an issue breaks or when there's a piece of legislation that we need people testifying for or against. We can get that message out, because as you know, media does not cover Republicans in the same fashion that they do cover the Democrats. So we need to create our own. And that's the other item that I hope carries over to the next chairperson.
Sue Hatfield, interim chair of the Connecticut Republican Party. Sue, thank you for the time. We appreciate it. Stay in touch, and you're always welcome here on the show. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Sue. Bye-bye. Sue Hatfield there. All right, so she's going to be in the gig until June. She's got a lot on her plate. Office of the Chief State's Attorney, for one, so that takes up time. And a former registered nurse at 9 years, at Yale New Haven, rather, for 9 years.